This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book that follows the fight for women's financial freedom in the 20th century and beyond. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about high school students learning about journalism through a video game.
We live in a time when fake news permeates social media feeds and partisan coverage blasts through some cable news channels. Teaching media literacy can help people wade through the disinformation and become critical news consumers. As Christina Leffering tells us, a video game created by UW-Madison's Field Day Labs aims to teach students to become more media literate.
This is the sound of a room full of newbie reporters having a very rough day.
I was fired for assaulting a crane.
Why'd you do that?
Spray it with pepper spray or run.
Why would you get fired for that?
Because I had to go to court or something because it was very illegal.
To be clear, Marshfield High School student Angel O'Brien Weber was not fired, and no cranes were assaulted. She and her classmates are playing Headlines and High Water, a computer game where they guide Elle Benjamin through her day as a rookie reporter at the fictional Twin Lakes Gazette. The city has flooded on the day of the Cherry Festival, and Elle has a limited amount of time to report and turn in stories about the flood. Similar to Choose Your Own Adventure, students like Jesus Mireles decide whether she helps her neighbor catch her loose chickens.
I lured him with food. That's pretty smart, by the way.
Absolutely.
Where to go and who to talk to. In Sarah Sharma's case, she got stuck on the phone with the town busybody, Fred.
Time my stupid cats for 45 minutes.
The goal is for students to turn in stories.
Your story isn't going so well.
Stupid Fred.
Hopefully good stories. On time to her boss. Sarah Gagnon from Field Day Labs, the Madison-based company that created Headlines in High Water, says initially the journalists were given budgets.
All the journalists that we talked to immediately reacted, and they're like, we don't have money.
Right.
We have time. That our currency is time.
Early decisions in the game affect outcomes later on. If Elle eats breakfast, she has more endurance. If she socializes, her interactions with people later on are more fruitful.
You need to have endurance. If you have to stay up really late, or you have to have tech skills, or you have to be able to earn people's trust.
Lindsay Whiting learned at least one valuable trick of the trade.
Food is the way to their hearts. If you bring them food, they'll tell you stuff.
But all students at some point run out of time.
Actually, one thing that has been really funny during all the testing with the kids is that it makes them so angry when people won't talk to them because they don't have enough trust. Or they feel like it's very unfair when they run out of time. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure journalists feel that way too.
They also have to find the right balance between facts, anecdotes that add color, and pictures. Joe Nyman turned in a breaking news story that was all photos and is now working on an article on wetlands.
I don't think my entirely picture article would have flown for the science one because that one required more factual evidence,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's a science article, it should not just be pictures.
The bigger goal is to get young people to think about news and its quality beyond whether it's real or fake.
News isn't perfect or fake. It's always going to be critiquable and something that we have to be questioning and engaging with.
Joe Nyman came away thinking about credibility and the quality of information.
Sometimes you have to fact check what other people say. So if someone says something and you're not quite sure about it, you have to go and check other people just to make sure that it's a good quality quote.
And hopefully it'll get some students to think about maybe becoming a journalist one day.
I don't like this job.
There's so many chickens in here.
I'm quitting.
But not Jesus.
I'm going back to farming. I don't like this job. I hate it.
Even if these students end up being farmers, teachers, or anything other than a journalist, hopefully they come away from this game understanding and appreciating the work journalists do. To not only get the story, but get the story right.
Christina Leffering brought us that story on the media literacy video game, Headlines and High Water. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. We may take it for granted that women have the right to participate in the U.S. economy as workers, consumers, business owners, and more. A lot of those rights came along pretty recently in the scope of American history. For one example, it's been just 50 years since the Equal Credit Opportunity Act took effect. Before that, a woman could be refused a credit card or other banking service because she was a woman. It took another 14 years to guarantee that women could get business loans without a male cosigner. In her new book, our next guest tracks the trajectory of women's financial freedom over the 20th century and where we stand today. Along the way, she introduces many of the women who fought for changes over the decades. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember when the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was passed yourself? Have you experienced gender discrimination as a job? How have pregnancy or access to childcare affected your career? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Josie Cox is a journalist who's written for Reuters, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. She's the author of the new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. Josie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
On the rise side of your book, Josie, you track many milestones for women in the financial world, in the business world, and more. A key point I took away from your book is none of those just sort of happened. There were people, there were women fighting for those changes every step of the way.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was the real motivation for me to actually sit down and write this book. I've been a journalist for about 15 years, mostly covering kind of financial markets, and always sort of, you know, wondered why the world of finance, the world of big money, as I characterize it, is still so male dominated. At the sort of highest echelons of business, we still see far more men than we see women. And so I sort of started delving into this topic, and I realized that the way to track, to sort of chronicle women's fight for financial freedom, as you put it, has to be through the women who fought for it, because their stories are so remarkable. And I often say that many of these women have been written out of history altogether, but perhaps it's even more accurate to say that they were never really written into history in the first place.
And that takes me to the first story you share in the book. Women worked in the United States before World War II, but the departure of a number of men to fight overseas brought a lot of women into an industrial workforce where they hadn't really been seen. And you talked to one of those women who made it her mission in the decades that followed to make sure that her story and the story of thousands and thousands of women wasn't lost. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest challenges I faced when I decided to tackle this topic was where to begin, right? Because you could really go back all the way through history and try and find the origin story of how women started to fight for financial independence. But World War II seemed to be a good place to start because, as you say, that was a time when women really in considerable numbers started coming into the paid labor market, as I like to describe it, taking the jobs of these men who were off at war and really proving that they were just as capable, just as competent at doing these jobs that were previously, you know, very much the domain of men. And so, you know, as I said, my motivation was to tell the stories through these individual women. I was fortunate enough to manage to find one of these real life Rosie the Riveters, as I refer to her. Her name is May. She lives in Pennsylvania. And as a teenager, she actually built Boeing aircraft in Seattle. So imagine the thrill of that. Being a teenage girl, she came from North Dakota, and she started building aircraft and realizing that she had this talent, this potential to actually quite literally and metaphorically roll up her sleeves and do these jobs, which up until that point had really been the jobs of her brothers and her father.
The war ended, the door slammed shut on her, had so many other women, and then there was a long slog, one step at a time. What are a couple of the key milestones at the workplace that you see for women over the next few decades after World War II?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when I set out to write the book, I knew that access to reproductive rights would necessarily be a really important part of this narrative. I didn't quite appreciate how central reproductive rights, access to contraception has been historically for women. And you know, you can see sort of the labor charts, the charts showing female labor force participation over time. And there's a huge uptick, you know, in 1960, which was the year that the first contraceptive pill became widely available across the US. And so, you know, whenever I'm asked what is the most important development of the 20th century for female economic empowerment, unequivocally, I believe it is the introduction of the oral contraceptive pill. And the story behind that introduction is wild. One of the women I profile in the book is a lady named Catherine Dexter McCormick, mm-hmm. who essentially single-handedly provided all the financing into the research and development that went into developing this pill that allowed women ultimately to plan when they wanted to start having babies, when they wanted to start having a family, and ultimately would help them to be able to not just have jobs throughout their lives, but real careers.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kristen is with us in Wausau. Kristen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on two things. One, that I've been working for, I had been a teacher, and then I left the teaching system and started working at the co-ops because I was taking care of my son after my divorce, and I was basically a woman in a man's world, and I was underpaid. I was promised a certain wage when I started, and then when I got my first paycheck, I was paid less. And when I drew it to their attention, they told me that was never the case, that they had agreed.
Oop.
And was driving there, and I was moved. I was told with everything that I did that I would get additional payment, you know, a higher rate. And they moved me up to trainer, and I trained all the new people. And at the point where everybody in the room when we had a meeting was hired after me, and everybody was paid more than me by about $3.
Kristen, thanks a lot for the call. Kristen, her line wasn't great there, Josie. Ultimately, the men she was training were getting paid more than her for training them. This is a huge part of the story you tell, unequal treatment and unequal pay at the workplace.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said at the beginning of this segment, you know, we have come an awful long way. And, you know, it's been many years since women could legally get fired for being pregnant, for example, or could, you know, legally be paid a different amount of money for doing the same job as a man. But I think what we're hearing from Kristen and from probably many other listeners who are listening to the program today, there still are so many examples of discrimination as a result of bias, conscious bias or unconscious bias. And so the law, you know, while it has come a long way, is still very imperfect in so many ways. So this is a fight that is going to last for a very long time.
Thanks for the call, Kristen. Josie Cox is with us. We're talking about her new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. It tells the story of the fight for women's financial freedom, equality at the workplace, and more over the last century or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman in a paid workplace, do you feel like people don't look at you the same? Do you not get paid the same? Do you not get respect? Do you not get the opportunity for advancement? If you hold a leadership position at a place of work, do you think your employees trust you more, less, or the same as male peers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Josie Cox, journalist, author of the new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Depending on how old you are, what is your perspective on women in the workplace? Do you feel like as a woman, you're just part of the team? Or do you feel like you're treated differently? Have you seen things change over the years, over the generations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Josie, I want to take things to the present day now. You looked in one of your chapters at Silicon Valley, right? The cutting edge of the American economy. And there are surveys and a lot of anecdotes and more showing stuff that we might associate, you know, with the Mad Men era, 1950s type business when it comes to the treatment of women. What kind of things do we see there?
Yeah, so I decided to delve into Silicon Valley because, as you say, it is such a hot pot of sexism in many cases. We hear so many stories of misogyny, of bias, of discrimination, quite frankly. And it makes up such a huge part of our economy. It's a hugely important sector. So many very large corporations employing people. So in many cases, you know, it sort of sets the pace for behavior in the workplace. It sort of sets the pace for what's acceptable behavior, what's corporate culture that we should all be aspiring to abide by. And so I decided to delve into that. I think what we've seen in Silicon Valley is a lot of companies growing extremely quickly and being founded by teams of individuals who sort of attract each other because they're very similar in many ways. They share similar interests. They resemble each other. They're pretty homogenous, in other words. And the thing with companies that grow quickly is that often the HR function, so to speak, kind of lags the growth of the company. So rather than focusing on creating a really considered work environment where every employee is able to reach their full economic and professional potential, regardless of their gender or their race or their sexual orientation or whatever other characteristic it might be. The mantra in Silicon Valley is very much to grow as fast as possible, to create profits as fast as possible, because that's the pressure that the investors in those companies are putting the companies under. And so what we see as a result of that is a sort of hotbed of behavior that is problematic. Women who feel very marginalized by these particular corporate cultures. And I share, you know, a couple of really interesting examples of that, and quite frankly, horrifying examples.
Let's go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. 1963, I graduated from high school. My first job was with the regional utility company here. Their policy was that women quit when they married. And then in 64, of course, the Equal Rights Act, they couldn't do that anymore. But at one point, I divorced my husband, and I couldn't get any credit. That was in 1982 because I didn't have any credit history, of course. And I remarried in my 30s, and my new husband had children from a prior marriage, and of course I had mine, and I wanted not to have children, and he wanted not to have more children, but my obstetrician gynecologist would not prescribe medication or perform any procedures because he didn't believe in that.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Josie, Vivian lived big, huge parts of the story you tell in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what she's talking about is so important because, you know, we have to remember that despite the fact that laws came into effect that essentially should have enabled her to get credit, that should have enabled her to have access to birth control and to contraception, in practice and in reality, in many cases, it just took an awful long time for sort of the real life to catch up with the letter of the law.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Samantha is with us now in Appleton. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking me on the show. I had called because I have had like a myriad of different jobs throughout my life, starting from when I was a teenager. But eventually, I saw sexism and unequal pay throughout many of my jobs, especially working in the food industry. And then I was also a correctional officer for the state of Wisconsin prison system, whereas I would volunteer time and effort to provide training services to new individuals who would then surpass me in rank, or I would be passed up for job opportunities or team working opportunities simply because it was a male that would be then added on to those teams.
Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. Josie, there are a lot of laws now in place that would try to tackle discrimination that Samantha experienced. How hard is it in practice to apply those laws, again, in somebody like Samantha's instance?
Yeah, I think Samantha's example and the other examples that we've heard today as well are sort of illustrative of the fact that laws, as I say, are imperfect. And I actually characterize laws in the book as sort of a fishing net with very large holes. And the most egregious offenses, so, you know, firing a woman for getting pregnant, for example, those things would get caught in that fishing net. But everything else still tends to slip through. And I'm thinking of things like microaggressions. I'm thinking of things like hiring decisions that Samantha was just talking about. We know that there are biases that are very dominant in the way that workplaces are shaped. And those biases, for, you know, examples of those biases are that we as humans tend to trust people more who resemble us physically or who share some kind of common heritage with us or who went to the same school or who have the same skin color as of us, for example. And those biases in many workplaces are still going unchecked. And so, you know, it's going to take a very long time. And I think that we all collectively have a responsibility to inform ourselves about these biases, to check ourselves on these biases, and to also have many open conversations in workplaces and in communities and in the home about the impact that these biases can have.
Samantha, thanks for sharing your story. And Josie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josie Cox, a journalist who's written for Reuters, The Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. So time for you to share your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, birdwatching can be a great hobby and a way to get outside, and it can be an inspiration to be better stewards of the environment. That's according to the author of the new book, Birding to Change the World. And large numbers of young adults say they're not so wild about capitalism thanks in part to economic roadblocks in their lives and because of treatment at workplaces. We'll dig into younger workers and the capitalist economy. And if you are under 40 and feeling that way yourself, again, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.